because I've got to go get ready to help with Vespers in the building. And I hope I can make myself understood. My voice is, I thought would be back by now, and it's not. I've been trying to squeeze too much into short days and not winning over my cold. For the sake of the tape, we can begin. This is the third session of four that I'm leading. I'm David Hokema on nonviolence and pacifism. This session is devoted to the nonviolent philosophies of Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King. And to begin, Rebecca Dezan is going to read a quotation from Mohandas Gandhi.
Nonviolence is a power which can be wielded equally by all children, young men and women, or grown-up people, provided they have all living faith in the God of love and therefore equal love for all mankind. When nonviolence is accepted as the law of life, it might pervade the whole being and not apply it to isolated acts.
Thanks, Becca. I'll talk about Gandhi's and King's philosophy of nonviolence, but I have to say at the beginning that to call their views in either case a philosophy is a bit of an exaggeration, because neither man was a philosopher, and both men, I think, would have been somewhat put off to be described as philosophers. Both were essentially men of action, and activists, social agents of change, whose philosophy emerged from their practices. So really, I'll talk more about their practices than about their the brief sketches of theory that are found in their writings. And so I'll really talk more about their lives, in a sense, than about their ideas per se. And I'm going to spend more time on Gandhi than on King, just because I think today in America, most people who move in the politically correct circles that Holden Village people tend to move in are reasonably familiar with the life of Martin Luther King Jr., not so many with the life of Gandhi. But I'll say something about both witnesses through their lives and the ideas that emerge from them, and then invite your response. Rebecca just read a nice capsule summary of Gandhi's commitment to nonviolence as a law of life, which Gandhi said can be practiced by anyone. It requires a fundamental commitment of the heart. That was a conviction that developed gradually. And I think it's important in studying Gandhi to realize that his ideas, at no point were his ideas fully fixed and systematized, that he was constantly shifting and constantly adapting what he saw as fundamental principles to fit new situations, even though at least past a certain point in his life, there were certain fixed principles that he did not want to compromise. But his early life is a story of someone who is casting about for a way of standing for justice, standing for a kind of fairness and dignity for all, and really trying a number of different tacks in order to achieve that. E. Stanley Jones, who is a great missionary and a close associate of Gandhi's, wrote in a lovely little book, Gandhi, Portrayal of a Friend, in the preface, he writes, he writes of his many disagreements with Gandhi, but of the deep bond between them. He writes that, he quotes someone else as saying that Gandhi was more right when he was wrong than most of us are right when we are right. And he closes this little preface, I bow to Mahatma Gandhi. By the way, a word about the names. Mahatma is a title that means person of great soul. It's almost like the title saint. It was bestowed on Gandhi by Rabindranath Tagore, one of India's greatest poets, and is often used, though I think simply for referring to the man, it's more appropriate to use his given name, which is Mohandas. But E. Stanley Jones writes, I bow to Mahatma Gandhi, but I kneel at the feet of Christ and give him my full and final allegiance. And yet a little man who fought a system in the framework of which I stand has taught me more of the spirit of Christ than perhaps any other man in East or West. This book is a symbol of my gratitude. Gandhi called himself Christian, Hindu, Muslim, Jew. But ethnically, of course, he was Hindu. And in the eyes of most Indians, I think throughout his life, he was Hindu. He was born in 1869, went to London in 1888 to study law, was something of a ne'er-do-well as a young man. In fact, his going to London was in part his family's attempt to straighten him out. He had fallen in with rather unsavory company, who taught him to do things like eat meat and drink and smoke. He went to London. In London, he adopted, and some of this is probably familiar. I imagine most of you have seen the film Gandhi, which is released about, I guess, 10 years ago now. Many little bits of Gandhi's life emerged in that film. The film, I think, is generally accurate, though somewhat romanticized. In London, he became rather a dandy. He affected British dress. After studying law in England, he went to South Africa. And in South Africa, initially practicing law, he saw for the first time with great clarity the structures of racism, the structured inequality of racially divided societies, which affected him as an Indian and affected, of course, the blacks and colors of South Africa even more. Bear in mind, the South Africa of the turn of the century was not a South Africa with a rigid system of racial apartheid. The system of apartheid came 50 years later, but it was a society which was very, in many ways, divided along racial lines. He wrote, at one point he wrote, "It has always been a mystery to me how men can feel themselves honored by humiliation of their fellow beings." And he began working in a variety of ways on behalf of the Indian, particularly the Indian minority, but also other non-white groups in South Africa. He returned to India in 1896, came back to South Africa with his family. In the Boer War, he supported the British, and in fact, he organized an army, an ambulance corps, which served with great distinction and at great risk, an Indian ambulance corps, which served in the Boer War. He returned to India in 1901, but was soon back in South Africa. He started a newspaper in South Africa, Indian Opinion, and this was to become a regular pattern, that many of his ideas were expressed through a newspaper that was started really to move a certain social movement along. In 1905, at the age of 36, he committed himself to a life of struggle against injustice, a life of voluntary denial, a kind of asceticism. At that time, he committed himself to be celibate. He committed himself never to have sexual relations with his wife or any other woman for as long as he lived. He committed himself to practice ahimsa, which is I believe it's a Sanskrit term, the denial of himsa or violence. The term ahimsa means nonviolence. And he committed himself to employ what he called, this is his own coinage, satyagraha. That's a coinage that means something like, means something like truth force or the power of truth. he said, another revealing quotation, "Those who say religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion means." And it was one of his deepest convictions that a true religion was essentially involved in politics and in issues of justice in society. Gandhi, from an early age, particularly having been exposed to both Islam and Hinduism in India, to Christianity in England, to Christianity and other faiths in South Africa, from an early age, Gandhi came to the conviction that there is a single truth that is behind all religions, that the doctrines of different religions, though they vary, they do not vary in essentials, and that behind them is a single truth. So he had an almost mystical attachment to a transcendent truth which underlies and undergirds all religions. He was influenced by a number of Western thinkers. He was influenced at one point in his life very strongly by John Ruskin, and like Ruskin, came to value manual labor. He introduced cottage industries in India, like using the spinning wheel. Some of you may have seen photographs of him sitting in the midst of diplomats working on his little spinning wheel. Like Ruskin, he believed that the industrialization had gotten society to a point where it was dehumanizing. We needed to restore honest manual toil and a kind of simplicity of life. He was influenced by Leo Tolstoy, in part by Tolstoy's own pacifism. There's a brief quotation in this anthology that is in the bookstore from Tolstoy. Tolstoy's own political philosophy was a rather perplexing mixture of a kind of aristocratic, it's hard to avoid a sense of aristocratic condescension, as well as a strong identification with the people. Tolstoy himself is a very complex and puzzling character. But what seems to have influenced Gandhi more than Tolstoy's occasional musings, occasional writings on the topic of nonviolence, was his moralistic tales. In fact, the little book What Men Live By, which is a little story of what's really essential in life, was something that Gandhi carried with him nearly everywhere he went. He was influenced also by some of the American pacifists. He read and sometimes cited William Lloyd Garrison, who was both an abolitionist in the anti-slavery movement and a pacifist. He also was influenced by Adin Ballou. One of the more interesting revelations to me in this anthology was the writings of Adin Ballou, whom I didn't know of before, who was a contemporary and acquaintance of Garrison's, who was one of the first in America to articulate a very clearly focused religious principle of nonviolence. But these ideas all came to application in the specific circumstances, first of South Africa and then of India. I'll mention just a couple of important campaigns in South Africa. One was the campaign of resistance to the Indian pass laws. The South African government required Indians to carry an identity card. In many ways, strikingly, a striking foreshadowing of the pass books that that became a subject of such controversy under apartheid 50 years later. And Gandhi organized a campaign of Indians to refuse to carry these passes. And it was quite successful, very, very, very widely followed. He also organized a campaign of public objection to a Supreme Court ruling in South Africa that, in essence, annulled most Indian marriages. There's a Supreme Court ruling that marriages that had not been registered with the civil authorities were null. Most Indians did not register their marriages. In the Indian subculture, marriages were considered binding when sealed between families. And the result of that court ruling was to rule most marriages to be simple affairs and most Indian children to be illegitimate. And Gandhi organized a campaign. Gandhi's wife, among others, were arrested in protest against that law. The response of the government authorities was very slow. Many people were arrested. Gandhi himself spent some time in jail. But eventually there was compromise, and eventually the South African authorities did see that the Indian resistance was strong and saw that they couldn't simply hold firm and expect the objections to go away, and they did compromise. Gandhi returned to London in 1914, very briefly, then went to India in 1915. On arriving in India, he established an ashram, a community, a kind of a farm community, and immediately took in members of the Untouchables caste as members. Gandhi was not in principle opposed to the Indian caste system. In fact, there are some sayings of Gandhi where he cites the Indian caste system as one of India's great cultural contributions. Gandhi thought in its principial beginnings, the caste system is defensible. Different people serving different functions in society. But in its practices, as he found it in India, he thought it was utterly indefensible. And in particular, he came to the defense of the Untouchables. He renamed them the Harijan, the children of God, and he took Untouchables into his ashram. Indians were very, very reluctant to live in a community in which Untouchables were present. But gradually he attracted a small band of followers, and throughout his life he established a series of communities, usually rural communities, in which he tried to live out his principles. There's a story of when his wife arrived in India, she was scandalized when he asked her not only to clean the latrines, but to do it with a smile. And the story is she finally did do the first, but didn't do the second. In the First World War, Gandhi was asked to recruit for the British, and he did so. He went from village to village trying to get recruits, volunteers, to serve with the British Army. He saw no inconsistency between that and his campaign for nonviolence and truth force. Those who believe in violence, he thought, ought to be prepared to use violence in defense of a cause that they believe is just. Had moderate degree of success. The first major campaign he led in India was against the Rowlatt Act. which, oh, I can't remember the details now, it had to do with Indian, with certain requirements of some kind of registration that made distinctions between different castes. That, the protest against the Rowlatt Act led to the incident Amritsar, which is shown with sickening detail in the film. An incident in which a couple of thousand protesters were gathered in Amritsar. British troops opened fire. Of 1,500 rounds of ammunition fired, only about 200 failed to strike somebody. And it was really like shooting fish in a barrel. It was an extraordinarily bloody massacre of unarmed resistors. This caused a good deal of revulsion, even on the part of some of those who supported the British Raj's side, though it's true, as the film reports, that the officer who led that disaster was decorated and awarded with military honors. Gandhi blamed himself for that disaster. Gandhi believed that the disaster resulted from the fact that he was asking people who were not spiritually prepared for a campaign of nonviolence to enter into such a campaign. In the ensuing years, he reorganized the Indian National Congress and turned that into a very important forum for Indian political aspirations. The other major campaign that, again, is documented very well in the film is the Salt March, the protest against the British law forbidding the use of any salt except that imported from India. It's a seemingly trivial issue, but it became a very important symbolic issue. Gandhi, in effect, demanded that the government relent. They wouldn't. They thought he was bluffing. He called their bluff and led a march 200 miles to the sea, where he walked into the sea, took some caked salt from the sea, ate it, and thereby symbolically broke the salt march laws. And that was one of those incidents that clearly gradually eroded both the practical and the moral authority of the British in India. Later in life, he turned again to the cause of the untouchables, and where he had very strong support in his campaign for Indian independence, his support in defense of the untouchables was much weaker. He was imprisoned many times. He spent 2,338 days in prison in his life of about 78 years. In 1948, in January, in the middle of January, a bomb went off at a prayer meeting he was attending, and he said, far from wanting to restrict his movements or change his patterns of behavior, he said he only hoped that if someone were to kill him, he would die with a smile and with firmness in his cause. And 10 days later, that's exactly what happened. A Muslim extremist, self-styled commando, shot him as he was on his way to a prayer meeting. I want to read a few quotations that give a sense of how he summarized his own philosophy of nonviolence. And these are from a collection. He wrote voluminously. He wrote an autobiography, which is called The Story of My Experiments with Truth, which is it's an enormous, sprawling book, often wanders very far from what seems to be the point. This is a good selection, which is from the Fulton Library here. A selection, All Men Are Brothers, of autobiographical reflections under a number of different subject headings. Gandhi wrote in 1925, "To me, God is truth and love. God is ethics and morality. God is fearlessness. God is the source of light and life, yet he is above and beyond all these. God is conscience. He is even the atheism of the atheist. He transcends speech and reason. He is a personal God to those who need his personal presence. He is embodied to those who need his touch. He is the purest essence. He simply is to those who have faith. He is all things to all men. He is in us and yet above and beyond us. He is long-suffering. He is patient, but he is also terrible. With him, ignorance is no excuse. And with all, he is ever forgiving, for he always gives us the chance to repent. He is the greatest democrat the world knows, for he leaves us unfettered to make our own choice between evil and good. He is the greatest tyrant ever known, for he often dashes the cup from our lips and, under the cover of free will, leaves us a margin so wholly inadequate as to provide only mirth for himself. Therefore, Hinduism calls it all his sport." 1931. And the newspaper called Harijan, devoted to the issue of the Untouchables. Gandhi wrote, "Nonviolence is the greatest force at the disposal of mankind. It is mightier than the mightiest weapon of destruction devised by the ingenuity of man. Destruction is not the law of the humans. Man lives freely by his readiness to die, if need be, at the hands of his brother, never by killing him. Every murder or other injury, no matter for what cause, committed or inflicted on another, is a crime against humanity." And in Young India, 1925, Gandhi wrote, "Nonviolence is not a resignation from all real fighting against wickedness. On the contrary, the nonviolence of my conception is a more active and real fight against wickedness than retaliation, whose very nature is to increase wickedness. I contemplate a mental and therefore a moral opposition to immoralities. I seek entirely to blunt the edge of the tyrant's sword, not by putting up against it a sharper-edged weapon, but by disappointing his expectation that I would be offering physical resistance. The resistance of the soul that I should offer would elude him. It would at first dazzle him, and at last compel recognition from him, which recognition would not humiliate, but would uplift him. It may be urged that this is an ideal state, and so it is." And last, this last little passage, also from Young India, speaks to the issue I spoke about on Monday, when I said that Gandhi hesitated to call himself a pacifist because he insisted that it's far better to be violent in resistance to injustice than to be inactive. That it is far worse to stand by and let injustice happen than to use violence, but that there is always another way. He wrote, again in 1926, "Nonviolence presupposes ability to strike. It is a conscious, deliberate restraint put upon one's desire for vengeance. But vengeance is any day superior to passive, effeminate, and helpless submission. Forgiveness is higher still. Vengeance, too, is weakness. The desire for vengeance comes out of fear of harm, imaginary or real. A man who fears no one on earth would consider it troublesome even to summon up anger against one who is vainly trying to injure him." Gandhi was a complex and, in many ways, not terribly attractive character from a Western perspective. I mentioned his decision at the age of 36 to commit himself to celibacy. To test his resolve, he carried out a practice that, to Western eyes, seems bizarre, of sleeping with young women to demonstrate that he had the resolve to remain celibate. He was, in many ways, would strike Westerners as obsessed with food, with the body, asked all of his associates and co-workers about their bowel movements every day. But against an Indian background, I think the pattern makes a great deal more sense. That is, he was a kind of holy man, a kind of Hindu holy man, who instead of committing himself to a simply individual campaign for holiness in his personal life, committed himself to a campaign for holiness in the entire life of the two nations in which he lived. I'll say more in a moment when I talk about King, about his religious convictions. I do find, as I said the other day in talking about pacifism, I think Gandhi's faith in a transcendent truth and his faith in a kind of inherent goodness of humankind are both, to my mind, misplaced. I think Gandhi was, it seems presumptuous to say it, but I think Gandhi was rather naive, both in supposing that the religions of the world do not differ in their essentials, and in supposing that there is a kind of fund of goodness that can be tapped if we remove the harmful effects of society. And yet, what Gandhi demonstrated, Gandhi's capacity to demonstrate the power of nonviolence, is to my mind as startling and as remarkable a demonstration as the demonstrations of August 1945 over Hiroshima and Nagasaki of the power of violence. And again, if you've seen the film of Gandhi, when you think of the power of the salt factory demonstrators who walked up rank upon rank, row after row, offering no resistance to the British guards, permitting themselves to be clubbed, permitting themselves to be treated cruelly, but simply refusing to surrender, refusing to give up their struggle, refusing to yield an inch in the principle that they must be treated with dignity and that their rights must be recognized. That scene in the film represents vividly the extraordinary power that Gandhi discovered in acting on the conviction that my enemy is a man or a woman just as I am, and that my enemy deserves my respect just as I deserve his respect. And if I call on the humanity of the enemy, I may be beaten, I may be killed, but I at least will not become like the enemy. And that, I think, was Gandhi's brilliant insight. Martin Luther King lived from 1929 to 1968. He did overlap by 20 years with Gandhi, though they never met. And King had a very strong interest in Gandhi's thought, but that interest really developed after Gandhi's death, at least as far as I know. King, of course, as I'm sure you are aware, was the son of a prominent black minister, studied for the ministry, studied modern theology, was in a parish himself, and in his parish in Montgomery, found himself drawn into the civil rights movement by the events going on around him, particularly by the Montgomery bus boycott. let me see. He studied the writings and the example of Gandhi. He traveled to India in 1959. In fact, a man associated with Gandhi came to America before that to talk to King about the notion of satyagraha, the notion of firmness in truth, or truth force. He certainly acknowledged on many occasions his debt to Gandhi. After the events that brought King to prominence in American public life came in the 60s. First of all, the Freedom Rides of 1961, then the mass demonstrations of 1963. And in the midst of those demonstrations, King wrote what is perhaps the single most powerful document of American nonviolence, that is his letter from the Birmingham City Jail, which is contained in this anthology, the O'Gorman Anthology. In that letter, he writes to the clergyman of Birmingham. He begins, "While confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling your present activities unwise and untimely. Seldom, if ever, do I pause to answer criticism by work and ideas. If I sought to answer all the criticisms across my desk, my secretaries would be engaged in little else in the course of the day, and I would have no time for constructive work. But since I feel that you are a man of genuine goodwill, and your criticisms are sincerely set forth, I would like to answer your statement in what I hope will be patient and reasonable terms." And he writes then a long letter about the reasons for the campaign in Birmingham, about the goals of that campaign, and about why he thinks it is only reasonable to call on the support of both black and white churchmen. He writes in that letter, "In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. One, collection of the facts to determine whether injustices are alive. Two, negotiation. Three, self-purification. And four, direct action. We have gone through all of these steps in Birmingham. There can be no gainsaying the fact that racial injustice engulfs this community." It's a very Gandhian way of putting the structure of the campaign. And Gandhi insisted. Gandhi fasted frequently. He fasted sometimes for the sake of getting the nation's attention on an issue, but he always fasted in preparation for a campaign to prepare himself spiritually. King goes on to write, "Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of police brutality is known in every section of this country. Its unjust treatment of Negroes in the courts is a notorious reality. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than in any city of this nation. These are the hard, brutal, and unbelievable facts. On the basis of these conditions, Negro leaders sought to negotiate with the city fathers, but the political leaders consistently refused to engage in good faith negotiation." And then he describes the steps that led to direct action. He says, "We sought compromise, we sought negotiation, but that was resisted, so we moved to direct action." He writes, "You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, etc.? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are exactly right in your call for negotiation. Indeed, this is the purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community that has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored." Now that, I think it's important to see, both in Gandhi's case and in King's. position. Well, nonviolence worked in India because, after all, there was a free press. The British were susceptible to moral appeal. Nonviolence worked in America because the press reported on it, because the moral conscience of the North was aroused, as if that were an objection. Both Gandhi and King would say, yes, precisely. That is, the point of nonviolence is, in part, to achieve the kind of publicity that will make the other side ashamed of his actions. And so the use of publicity is not in any way grandstanding, it's part of the tactic. That is, by putting the other side in the spotlight, by making them stand up to those who otherwise would ignore the situation, by dramatizing the contrast, by forcing India to read about British officers clubbing down unarmed protesters, the Protesters Against Assault Act compels the British to defend their actions. So the publicity is an integral part. It's not in any way a diversion from the core of direct action. King goes on to describe the background, to describe the reasons for breaking the law. He gives a rather extensive account of just and unjust laws. Here he's very traditional. In fact, he's writing, he cites St. Thomas Aquinas. He's using really classic Catholic moral theology. He says, in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. And he says, we have no obligation to obey laws such as laws upholding segregation that degrade human personality. He talks about the white moderates and his disappointment that white moderates have not come to his support. He describes himself as an extremist for love. He says, perhaps I was an extremist. Was not Jesus an extremist in love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Was not Paul an extremist for the gospel of Jesus Christ? And then he says, of the white church, here we are moving toward the exit of the 20th century with a religious community largely adjusted to the status quo, standing as a taillight behind other community agencies, rather than a headlight leading men to higher levels of justice. And a little excerpt from the close of that letter. One day the South will recognize its real heroes. They will be the James Merediths, courageously and with majestic sense of purpose, facing jeering and hostile mobs and the agonizing loneliness that characterizes the life of the pioneer. They will be old, oppressed, battered Negro women, symbolized in the 72-year-old woman of Montgomery, Alabama, who rose up with a sense of dignity and with her people decided not to ride the segregated buses and responded to one who inquired about her tiredness with ungrammatical profundity. My feet is tired, but my soul is rested. They will be the young high school and college students, young ministers of the gospel, and a host of their elders courageously and nonviolently sitting in at lunch counters and willingly going to jail for conscience' sake. One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat down at lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian heritage. His reference to disinherited children of God strikes me as probably invoking Gandhi's attachment to the Harijan. That gives a good flavor, I think, of King's understanding of his principial stand, of the necessity of civil disobedience, the necessity of nonviolence. From Birmingham, of course, King went on to even greater prominence, most notably in the March on Washington in August 1963, where on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial he gave his most famous speech, the I Have a Dream speech. As Vincent Harding and others have been pointing out in recent years, the American image of King's tends to be frozen in August 1963, when he gave such an eloquent appeal to overcome racial inequality and injustice, to let white children and black children play together and worship together and go to school together. The American image of King forgets that in the years after 1963, until his death in 68, he increasingly insisted on a linkage between civil rights issues and issues of war. Was an early and vocal opponent of the Vietnam War, which earned him a cancellation of his invitation to visit the White House. He had good relations with JFK and with Robert Kennedy, which soured after he became a vocal opponent of the war. It put severe strain in his relations to other civil rights leaders, and in his last years, King was to a large extent ostracized by much of the civil rights leadership because he insisted on tying issues of violence in war to issues of violence and race relations. He came to the conviction that one couldn't address one evil without addressing the other, and that in order to address the evils of racism, one also had to address the evils of militarism. The King that is remembered, the King who was so warmly saluted by people like President Reagan on his birthday, was a King who preached racial equality and didn't say much about other issues of violence. But the King who lived another 5 years after that I Have a Dream speech was one who came more and more to see, as Gandhi did, that all the different kinds of violence are related, and that seriously to address one kind of violence necessarily means addressing the roots and the forces that sustain other modes of violence as well. King saw one great triumph in the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, which came about through a very complex set of negotiations between King and other civil rights leaders, the Johnson White House. It's fair to say it would not have happened without visionary leaders like King. I think it's also fair to say it would not have happened without the extraordinary political skills of unscrupulous men like LBJ. And as in most moral triumphs, there's a lot of mixed motives behind it. But it was a great legal step forward. In some ways, like the British commitment to leave India. That, unfortunately, was followed by a couple of years of intense racial tension, which again is somewhat reminiscent of the Hindu-Muslim riots that followed the British decision to leave India. The riots of the summers of 65 and 67 were extraordinarily destructive. There are sections of our inner cities that have never been reconstructed since. And King, like Gandhi, felt he had failed, that the movement for racial equality had failed if it could spawn such violence. King was killed, of course, by an assassin in 1968. He, too, was a complex man. Both Gandhi and King, I think, are good examples of the fact that in the 20th century, we tend to know too much about our saints. I mentioned some of the oddness of Gandhi's character. King, as we come to know in recent years, was a man whose moral life was far from impeccable, who was rather given to chasing other women besides his wife. He was a person whose standards of honesty and reporting in his own writings was something less than we would normally expect. He tended to recycle others' work as his own. And yet, none of that, I think, diminishes the greatness of his example as someone who very much, from an American standpoint, rooted in American evangelical Christianity, translated that into a form that spoke very specifically to the problems of violence in our society. I'd like to close what I say by reading a couple of quotations from another piece of King's. This is an essay on nonviolence. That's actually somewhat earlier. It's from 1960. Because I think it answers some of what I was saying about my own misgivings about Gandhi's view of human nature and Gandhi's theology. King writes here, he's writing autobiographically about his senior year in seminary. He said, "My early theological training did the same for me as the reading of Hume did for Kant. It knocked me out of my dogmatic slumber. At this stage of my development, I was a thoroughgoing liberal. Liberalism provided me with an intellectual satisfaction that I could never find in fundamentalism. I was absolutely convinced of the natural goodness of man and the natural power of human reason. The basic change in my thinking came when I began to question some of the theories that have been associated with so-called liberal theology. Of course, one phase of liberalism I hope to cherish always, its devotion to the search for truth, its insistence upon an open and analytical mind, its refusal to abandon the best light of reason. It was mainly the liberal doctrine of man that I began to question. The more I observed the tragedies of history and man's shameful inclination to choose the low road, the more I came to see the depths and strength of sin. My reading of the works of Reinhold Niebuhr made me aware of the complexity of human motives and the reality of sin on every level of man's existence. Moreover, I came to recognize the complexity of man's social involvement and the glaring reality of collective sin, collective evil. I came to feel that liberalism had been all too sentimental concerning human nature and that it leaned toward a false idealism." Then skipping forward a bit, he writes of Walter Rauschenberg's influence upon him. He said it left a lasting mark, though he some aspects of Rauschenberg he was dissatisfied with, but others he thought were essential. Any religion, he says, he writes, that professes to be concerned about the souls of men and is not concerned about the slums that damn them, the economic conditions that strangle them, and the social conditions that cripple them, is a spiritually moribund religion awaiting burial. After reading Rauschenbusch, he says, I turned to a serious study of the social and ethical theories of the great philosophers. During this period, I'd almost despaired of the power of love in solving social problems. Then I came upon the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. As I read his works, I became deeply fascinated by his campaigns of nonviolent resistance. The whole Gandhian concept of satyagraha was profoundly significant to me. As I delved deeper into the philosophy of Gandhi, my skepticism concerning the power of love gradually diminished, and I came to see for the first time that the Christian doctrine of love, operating through the Gandhian method of nonviolence, was one of the most potent weapons available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom. At this time, however, he says, I had a merely intellectual understanding, with no firm determination to organize in a socially effective situation. And then he writes, I better stop, my voice is going to give out. When I was convinced during my student days of the power of nonviolence and group conflicts within nations, I was not yet convinced of its efficacy in conflicts between nations. I felt that while war could never be a positive or absolute good, it could serve as a negative good in the sense of preventing the spread and growth of an evil force. But more and more, I have come to the conclusion that the potential destructiveness of modern weapons of war totally rules out the possibility of war ever serving again as a negative good. If we assume that mankind has a right to survive, then we must find an alternative to war and destruction. In a day when Sputniks dash through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, nobody can win a war. The choice today is no longer between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. Well, I better say no more, or I'll lose my voice entirely. That, I think, gives a capsule of the way in which, it seems to me, Gandhi influences King to adapt what was for Gandhi not a strategy. Nonviolence, Gandhi would never consider nonviolence a strategy, but a mode of action, and roots it in what I think is, in King's case, though not developed with great theological depth, I think a rather subtle and, to my mind, theologically very defensible understanding of the potential for good and the potential for evil in human society. Let me stop there and invite your comments and questions. Rob?
David, have you interacted at all with James Cone's recent analysis of King in relationship to Malcolm X, where he argues that toward the end, you know probably his argument. As I understand it, Cone argues that even as Malcolm X retreated from a hard line, violent change by violence position to one that would be more of a nonviolent position, so also did King retreat from his nonviolent position to take up Malcolm X's change by violence.
Yeah.
Or both of them sort of moderated, but they came closer and closer together in trying to find a synthesis between those two.
Yeah. No, I know that Cone argues that. I guess I'm not.
It's in his book, Martin and Malcolm.
Right. No, I've not read that book. I've seen the signs of that in Malcolm X's later writings and speeches. I guess I find it less convincing of King. And the two really almost ignored each other and saw each other as working at very different ends of the problem. I don't see in King any turn toward... I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that he was moving toward violence, though he was clearly moving toward a much more systematic analysis of the causes of violence. And in that sense... In that sense, I think it's fair to say that the Martin Luther King, whom an earlier Malcolm X dismissed as an idealist, was not present any longer at the end of King's life. That is, King could fairly have been accused of a kind of idealistic overestimation of the power of principled action.
Yeah.
I think late in life he understood that, that without fundamental change in the structures of society, including economic structures, change wouldn't come.
I guess that would be, and it could be too, that there's a greater degree of emphasis placed upon segregation by King toward the end, rather than giving up almost the hope of integration that you hear in the 63rd. But the violence I had in mind was more the need to do other things to change the structures than simply act in nonviolence.
Yeah. But I know of that book, but I don't have it.
Can you talk a little bit more about Gandhi and when he was recruiting for the British Army and how he justified that? Or I find that in my studies of Gandhi that there does seem to be he's not a purist when it comes to nonviolence, but I don't get how can you justify it within yourself if you are.
I don't know. I don't think Gandhi ever wrote about that. I don't think he ever formally tried to justify what he had done, at least not that I've come across. But I think his position was the British cause in World War I is a just cause. That is, they are fighting to right an injustice. When there is an injustice present, we are obliged to oppose it with whatever means are at our disposal. And those who believe in using the weapons of war, if you believe in using the weapons of war, you ought to use them when the time calls for it. Now, some of Gandhi's opponents saw it as a very opportunistic thing. That he was asked to recruit. It was not as if he initiated. He was asked to recruit because of the enormous influence as a public figure. And so his opponents said this was simply trying to buy credit with the British that he would spend later, as he was willing to help them in this way, hoping they would help him on the other side. And I don't know, and that's possible. And in the teens, I don't think his ideas were as fully formed as they were 10 or 20 years later. But all his life, he was you have the sense that he wasn't closed to any tactics that were not obviously and blatantly unacceptable to the person who used them, so that he would form alliances with others, even if others were using tactics he didn't approve of. On the other side of that, an interesting sort of, on the one hand, he did, at least in 18, recruit for the British Army. On the other hand, he acknowledged that his use of fasting was a coercive tactic. He acknowledged that when he entered a fast, he was coercing the other side, that it had tremendous power, and that on many occasions when he was in a long fast, he knew that he was leaving his enemy virtually no option, and he used that tactic sparingly because he knew how powerful it was. I mean, it was the threat of destroying himself was the threat that he wielded, but he knew just how powerful that tactic could be. So he was reluctant to fast, which was only destroying himself. He was willing to recruit for the army, which was in some sense in contradiction to his principle of nonviolence. But I don't know, and it's puzzling. And certainly in the Second World War. In the Second World War, I mentioned the other day, he said a variety of things that are troubling about he criticized the Jews for not showing principled nonviolent resistance, for being too passive in the face of evil. Which, you know, as you read some of his comments, it really seems to betray a great ignorance about what the situation of Jews in Europe was. But he also said, against a force like Hitler, one could use nonviolence, and then one would really see the force of nonviolence. Though he didn't forthrightly condemn the use of violence against Hitler. Those who could only see the way of violence should use the way of violence, but those who could see another way should use another way.
How can you condone the opposite of what they're trying to?
Well, see, it's not the opposite. For Gandhi, the opposite would be to stand by idly.
But as long as you have conviction, you can do anything. So I disagree with murder, but as long as the murderer has conviction, then go ahead and murder. How can you condone that in that way?
Well, no, I mean, it's not.
It seems to lose credibility then if you are in that way, unless I'm not seeing it correctly.
The test, litmus test was conviction, whether somebody had conviction or not, whether or not they were fighting injustice, whether they did it violently or not violently, is not as important as the fact that they were doing something to fight injustice.
So if you're struggling for truth, if you're struggling for equality, if you're struggling for dignity of all persons, then the fact that you're using violent means is unfortunate. There are better means. If you had the spiritual preparation, you could do it nonviolently. But what you are doing is better than a person who stands back and says, my principles don't permit me to kill. There is nothing to be done against Hitler except fight. Therefore, I must be exempted from armed service because I can't. You know. The person who seeks CO status and stays home would, in Gandhi's eyes, be far less admirable than the person who goes and fights. But you said commit murder. No, and Gandhi would never condone committing murder. That is, committing the killing of another person for personal revenge or something of that sort. But killing, I mean, I think Gandhi's response would be, if you are to go to war, then principles about justified war and so forth are principles you should observe. Now, those all represent for Gandhi a morality that is inferior to the morality of nonviolence. And yet, you cannot act. I mean, this is Gandhi is convinced you cannot act at a level that you are not spiritually committed to. And so to use nonviolence, and Gandhi was very much opposed to using nonviolence as a tactic, very much opposed to satyagrahi, for the followers of satyagraha, trying to recruit a large public to come in and say, join our campaign, use our nonviolent tactics. You know, we're going to do this massive campaign, come and join us. And he said, no, you mustn't use the tactics of nonviolence unless you are so deeply committed that you can follow through to the end and not swerve from your determination to use nonviolence. And what he saw as going wrong again and again in India was that nonviolence was used as a tactic, as a political tactic. And when it went wrong, when it didn't achieve its results, the people who had embraced nonviolence because they thought it would get them their ends then said, oh, that didn't work, we'll try something else. And Gandhi's response was, they should have used what they were committed to. They should have used violent means. If their consciences would permit them to use violence, better for them to begin with an armed revolt than to begin with a nonviolent movement which would then become violent as soon as it's frustrated. You should use nonviolence only if you're prepared to stick it out to the end, to face death rather than turn to violence. Yes?
Do you see any world figureheads today espousing the same nonviolence of Gandhi or King?
Not really. Some of the African leaders, I think, have come close. Julius Nyerere, in particular, in Tanzania. You could make an argument that his experiment in Tanzania failed miserably, which in many ways it did. But his notion of a kind of distinctively African socialism, I think, contained many of those ideals. I don't think Nyerere would call himself a pacifist, but his notion of a kind of humane economy that would have room for all and would give no one too much and no one too little has something of that. We do have an example in Costa Rica of a country that has been governed with principled refusal to have a standing army. I talked the other day about the example of movements like Solidarity. The other day we talked about what's happened in Eastern Europe the last few years, and it can't be said that all of the changes in Eastern Europe were motivated by a principle of nonviolence, but the Solidarity movement in particular did consider that question quite specifically and commit itself to nonviolent social change. But in terms of world leaders, not really. My personal view is that someone like Mikhail Gorbachev was one of the few leaders we've seen who really saw beyond the present situation to a world in which relations between nations would have been changed fundamentally, and perhaps, had he managed to retain power, would have moved to a stage where he would have called for a real renunciation of violence rather than just arms control. But events move so quickly that we won't ever know. And I guess I would say the same about, had circumstances been different, I think the same might well have been true of Jimmy Carter. that Carter was a man of deep religious and moral vision, who, for a variety of unfortunate reasons, entered office proclaiming the folly of the arms race and left office boasting about how much he'd increased the military budget. But under different circumstances, I think he might have led the way in that direction. That's part of what I want to talk about tomorrow. I want to talk about whether there is a global politics of nonviolence that's possible. Yes?
This is just a peripheral observation, but Gandhi's life was made the subject of an opera by Philip Glass called Satyagraha.
Yes.
Would that be that word?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Without that R in it.
Sorry?
There's an extra R in there.
Oh, I spelled it wrong. I'm sorry. Satyagraha.
Satyagraha.
What did I do wrong?
That's it.
That R is the long one. I'm sorry.
No, we did it
right. I'm glad you pointed that out. Satyagraha.
Satyagraha.
Satya means truth, and graha means grasping after. Yes. Yeah. Glass's opera, which is, my mind, almost as long and tedious as Gandhi's autobiography. But it tries to work with some of the same themes and presents some episodes in Gandhi's life.
One last final question. I was just curious. You kind of touched on it. Do you think, is it possible to have a nonviolent war where the whole society or unscrupulous people? Is it still possible?
I'm sorry, I have nonviolent war, and what was the rest of that?
Nonviolent war in a society that's closed, doesn't have the press, doesn't have, there's a lower moral.
Oh, I see. I don't know, and that's a difficult question, and I think, you know, I said that use of the press was essential, both to Gandhi and to King. Very likely not, and very likely a kind of principled, concerted action can have an effect only when it has publicity, and it can have publicity only when there is some freedom to report it. That's not to say that there can't be acts of great courage, but I think they probably can't have the kind of widespread effect that they had both in India and the civil rights movement without the attention of the nation and of the world being directed on them. So I suppose in a closed and highly controlled society, the most you could hope for is isolated acts that might address very particular injustices, but not something that would lead to a movement. And in that way, you know, in that way, I think, though the notion of nonviolence is very old, and certainly, I mean, Gandhi was calling on some very traditional Hindu sources and saying, once you live, the Jains, for example, live a principle of doing no harm to anyone, to any living creature. He's calling on some very ancient precedents. At the same time, to use this as a tactic for social change probably does depend essentially on having 20th century means of communication. Two quick ones, then we have to close.
Mine is just a personal comment, I guess, David. I still find it hard. I mean, I can respect the nonviolence qualities and philosophies in both of these people, but I find it hard to have real respect for them as human beings when they talk about integrity for all people and misuse women in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's up close or whether it's general, I just find that difficult.
Yeah.
And I don't personally dismiss that in people that I...
Yeah. Well, that was certainly an Achilles heel of both men.
Mm-hmm.
That is, Gandhi's relationship with his wife was very disturbing,
mm-hmm.
And King's with women was also rather disturbing. Yes.
Do you see practicing principles of nonviolence having relevancy to working with children?
I think I'll have to say yes and then stop. Certainly. I haven't done much of that myself. I haven't really worked in education. But there are some good books. There's a book by Catherine Jo McGinnis called Parenting for Peace and Justice. I think there are a lot of ways in which it's possible very early to plant the notion that conflicts call for creative resolution that permits each side to respect the other, rather than winning. And I think it's very clear. It's very clear that the patterns of violence and of, you know, the quotation I read from Gandhi that one can gain, we can feel ourselves honored by humiliation of fellow human beings. That pattern is planted very early in childhood, and if it's going to be changed, it has to be changed very early in childhood. Well, I need to cut off because we need to. can go to Vespers. But tomorrow, tomorrow I will talk much less.